Well, hello, and welcome to Mr. Ippolito's Quarter 3 Benchmark Review Podcast. Now, the best way for you to follow this podcast is to have your benchmark standards guide out in front of you. You can get the standards guide on MrIppolito.com. I will be going through this standard by standard so you know exactly what to expect on the benchmark exam. All right, let's begin with standard 7.6.1. This standard asks us to study the geography of Europe. For this standard, I urge you to study the map of Europe from the medieval unit on page 7 of your INB. Know all the features of this map. Again, that's the map on page 7 of your INB. So that's really simple. That's standard 7.6.1. Moving right along, let's talk now about standard 7.6.3. That wants us to understand the role that feudalism played in medieval Europe. Now, feudalism, you remember, was the economic, social, and political structure of medieval Europe. So you know this standard is going to be big on the test, and you can bet there will be several questions related to this standard. This was level 3 of your levels project. It was the front and back of page 6 in your INB, and you can also review chapter 14, section 3 of your textbook. For sure, you'll need to know the different levels of the feudal system. Now, you can find this on page 11 of your INB. It's also on MrIppolito.com. If you just type feudalism into the search box, and you can pull that up so that you can see what we wrote on the board. You should understand the lord-vassal relationship of feudalism, the fact that the person above you, your lord, most likely provided you with land and protection, and in exchange, you, the vassal, provide loyalty and service. So that's the relationship between the person above you, your lord, and the person below the lord, the vassal. So that's 7.6.3. So make sure that you understand all of those different elements of feudalism. So next is standard 7.6.4, which asks us to understand the power that the Pope had in medieval Europe and examine the relationship between the Pope and Charlemagne, and later the Pope and King Henry IV. Now, you know, if your 8th grade history teacher next year asks you where power comes from in the United States government, where does the president's power come from? Where does Congress's power come from? I hope you would answer that our government's power flows from the people. We believe that in the United States today, because that's how our country was founded. But back in medieval Europe, they believed that political power flowed from God. And that meant the Pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, was enormously powerful during this time. The Pope was the leader of the Church. He was the most powerful religious leader in all of Christendom. And so he's going to have a lot of political power as well, because everybody knew in medieval Europe that in the political structure of feudalism, God was at the top. And then all power flowed from God. Now, when there was chaos and darkness in the centuries that followed the fall of Rome, one leader rose up to unite Europe. We're talking about Charlemagne. So who was the person to put the crown on Charlemagne's head? That's right, the Pope. Very powerful. When King Henry IV wanted more control over the selection of bishops in his part of Germany, and he didn't get his way, and he got excommunicated from the Catholic Church, who did he go to, begging on his knees barefoot in the snow? The Pope. Now, of course, we live in a more secular society today, but back then the Pope was enormously powerful, and the Church played a huge role in people's lives, so you got to remember that. All right, next is standard 7.6.5, which wants you to understand the beginnings of the principles of our own United States government and how those principles first started to be formed in medieval Europe. Let's go back to King John. Remember the king from Robin Hood? King John was a horrible king, taxing his people without the consent of the nobles, throwing people in jail and not giving them a good reason for doing so. He was abusing his power. Now, kings had a lot of power back then, but even the nobles of 13th century England said enough is enough, and forced King John, for the first time in English history, to limit his power. On the fields of Runnymede, England, in the year 1215, King John signed what could be considered the most important document in English history, a Great Charter between the king and his people. So it's like a contract or an agreement. This Great Charter is better known by its Latin name, Magna Carta. In it contains language that limits the power of the king. It creates for the first time something called the Great Council. This is later going to become Parliament. That's the legislature in England. It's our version is Congress. It prevented the king from raising taxes without the consent of the Great Council. It guaranteed those people accused of crimes against the crown the right to a trial by jury of their peers. And it protected the accused from being thrown in jail for no good reason. That right is known as habeas corpus. That's Latin for present the body. Someone would get thrown in jail. Some family member or friend would go to the jail and say, present the body. Let me see my friend or my family member because we don't even know why they got thrown in jail. So the right of habeas corpus was also protected for the first time under Magna Carta. If you understand Magna Carta now, you will impress your 8th grade history teacher because you'll need to know it all over again for the first quarter of next year. So just lock that away for next year, but also keep it handy for the benchmark as well. All right, now on to Standard 7.6.6, the Crusades. Now, Level 6 in your Levels project is all about the Crusades, so that's a good place to start if you're studying. Also, Chapter 15, Section 3 in your textbook. The standard is very clear on what you're supposed to learn about the Crusades. Focus on the interaction between Christians, Muslims, and Jews during this time. Why did Europeans leave the comfort and safety of their farms, their homes, to go thousands of miles away, possibly never to return home? Finally, the standard wants us to know the effects of the Crusade, the lasting impact. I'll talk about that just briefly. Europe was forever changed by those wars, mostly because they were exposed to things that they had never experienced before, things like silks and spices from the Far East. The Crusades had the effect of showing Europe that there's a whole other world out there, and that excited them. I'm going to argue that without the Crusades, there's not that interest in travel, in trade, and in exploration. I think without the Crusades, Italy would not have become the trade crossroads that it became, and perhaps the Renaissance never would have happened, or would have happened very differently. I'm also thinking that without the Crusades, the age of exploration, we haven't studied that yet, we're about to in the next few weeks, that wouldn't have come to be, or wouldn't have happened in the same way. People like Vasco da Gama, Sir Walter Raleigh, Christopher Columbus, all of these explorers owe their success to the curiosity that was stirred during the Crusades. All right, so that's the Crusade standard. Let's move now to standard 7.6.6. That was 7.6.6. Let's move on to 7.6.7. That's the Black Death. Now, you want a great review of the Black Death? It's real easy. Just watch the Brain Pop video that I put online. If you just in the search box on MrAppolito.com, you put in Brain Pop or you put in Black Death, and it'll come right up. It's the same video that we watched in class, but it's worth watching again. It's like 4.5 minutes, and it's the perfect Black Death review. Now, if you don't want to do that, then Chapter 16, Section 3 in the textbook is good, or Level 8 in your Levels project is good as well. All right, so I'm moving on from Black Death. I'm going to move now to Standard 7.6.8, which is all about the Catholic Church as a political, intellectual, and aesthetic institution. I'm quoting directly from the standard. In language the average person can understand, this means that you need to know how the university system began in the monasteries, that the church was a center of learning in Europe during the medieval period. So that's, there really wasn't an emphasis on secular learning. People didn't go to school the way that you do today. There was no such thing as, everyone deserves an education. Back then, education was very limited. Not even the wealthy got a limited education, but really that learning, that trying to pass knowledge on from one generation to the next, access to books is really limited to members of the church, specifically those monks that were in those monasteries and maintaining that knowledge, copying those books. So there really wasn't, in general medieval European society, wasn't much of an emphasis placed on education. You also need to review the religious orders, monks and nuns, and you need to know the difference between the first types of orders that we studied, and then the mendicant orders. That was the kind that St. Francis and St. Clair of Assisi belonged to. For more review on this, page 9, page 10 in the INB are good, along with level 7 in the Levels Project. If you're going to the textbook, chapter 14, section 2, chapter 16, section 2, also good for the textbook. All right, so that's 7.6.8. Now, standard 7.6.9, the Reconquista. This was that E-Day, this was a couple weeks ago, when Mr. Jacobs taught you all about King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, and how their marriage united two Christian kingdoms in Spain. They then set about to conquer the lands in Spain that had been occupied by Muslims for nearly 800 years. These Muslims were originally from North Africa, and so they're a special group of Muslims called Moors. After successfully pushing the Moors out of Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella wanted to further purify their country, make it a completely Christian, country. Everyone on the Iberian Peninsula should be a Christian. That was their belief. And so they wanted to get rid of the Jews as well. Anyone who did not follow Christianity was subject to torture and death in a time known as the Spanish Inquisition, where thousands of Jews and Muslims were executed for their faith. It wasn't Christianity's finest hour, but it's an important part of our history that you need to understand. So that was the Reconquista, and that's standard 7.6.9. By the way, I don't know if I ever mentioned, but the word Reconquista is Spanish for reconquering or reconquest. So that's this whole idea of reconquering the Iberian Peninsula in the name of Christianity. So that's where that comes from. All right, let's see if we can lighten things up now with standard 7.8.1, which now brings us to the Renaissance. 7.8.1 wants us to trace the roots of the Renaissance, and you should know this because we talked about it in class. Specifically, the standard uses the language, the revival of classical learning, humanism, and a balance between intellect and religious faith. So as we discussed extensively, the word classical in this sense refers to the two classical empires, and of course that's ancient Greece and ancient Rome. So whenever you hear the term classical period or classical learning or classical civilizations, they're talking about Greece and Rome. Europeans living in the late 1300s and early 1400s look back at the history of Europe. And for about the past 800 years, life in Europe was pretty lousy under feudalism. It was awesome if you were a king or queen, a noble, a knight. You lived pretty well if you were in that top 5% of European culture or European society. But for the 95% of the population that were peasants, serfs, it's the same thing, they had to work the land with no possibility of ever moving up in the world. There's no possibility of their children or grandchildren ever doing any better. There was no social mobility, and so there was no celebration of life, art, culture, literature, philosophy, drama. Medieval Europe was dull. And to top it all off, a third of the population died in the Black Death. Fail. So Europeans living in the late 1300s and early 1400s desperately wanted to go back to a time when Europe was awesome, when there was art, culture, music, celebration. That was ancient Greece and Rome. They wanted a rebirth of that time. That's what the word Renaissance means in French, a rebirth. They wanted a return to the time when life was not dominated by the church and people had a little more balance and freedom. They wanted a more secular existence. We've used that word before, meaning life does not revolve around religion, where there could be a balance between living a holy and religious life. It's not a rejection of religion altogether, but it's a balance between religion, also having fun celebrating the power of the human spirit, of the individual, individualism. This was the change that the Renaissance created. So that's standard 7.8.1. So now standard 7.8.2 wants you to specifically know why the Renaissance began in Italy. What was it about that location, that part of Europe, that made towns like Florence and Venice the centers of learning, art, and culture? The standard specifically says emphasis on the city's importance in the spread of Renaissance ideas. So let me explain. After the Crusades, what did Europeans want? They wanted stuff from Asia. They had gone to the Middle East. They had been to Jerusalem. They had seen all these amazing new things that they had never seen before in Europe. Now, you can't just order spices from India or gold jewelry from Africa on Amazon.com back in the 14th century. So who gets this stuff for you if you can't go online and order it? Because the internet will not be invented for another 600 years. Who gets it for you? Traders. Specifically, we need to find out where these traders are going to come from. Who makes the best traders? What part of Europe is at the crossroads of Europe, Africa, and Asia? What part of Europe is sticking right out into the middle of the Mediterranean Sea? Well, of course, it's Italy. So, these Italian traders are starting to make lots of money by selling these exotic goods to the rest of Europe. These goods are becoming more and more in demand as the middle class rises. As the Black Death decreased the population of Europe by a third, and so wages are now going up. People can demand more money. More people are living better, and so as people are living better, there's a greater demand for these goods. So these traders are starting to make lots of money by selling these goods to the rest of Europe. They're getting rich. A wealthy businessman in Italy today, in 2011, might cruise by you in his convertible Ferrari, and he cruises by as his ciao. But there are no Ferraris. Remember ciao from our Italian lesson. No Ferraris, no Lamborghinis, Bugattis, Maseratis back in the 1400s. So how do wealthy Italians show off their wealth? Through expensive art. They become patrons, people who are so rich that they can afford to have their own private artists whose full-time job it is to simply paint or sculpt. This patronage system results in some of the most beautiful art the world has ever seen, and this is why Italy becomes the birthplace of the Renaissance. Okay, let's shift gears and go from the art of painting and sculpture really quickly to the art of writing. And this is standard 7.8.4. This standard wants you to know all about books and the change in the way that books were printed. You remember that back in the Middle Ages, books were copied slowly, by hand, by monks in cold, dark monasteries. A Bible could take months or even years to copy. And while the result was a beautiful book, if you go to the Getty Museum, you can see the what are called the illuminated manuscripts. These are manuscripts, Bibles, and other books that were copied by monks 700-800 years ago, and you can see how amazingly beautiful these books are. But it took a terribly long time to copy, and as a result, these books were terribly expensive. Only the very wealthy would have been able to afford books like these because they're hand-created. The Chinese, you remember, when we studied China, invented woodblock printing 1,000 years before the Renaissance, but it was Johannes Gutenberg, a goldsmith from Germany, who was the first to invent the movable type printing press, a way to easily create characters out of metal. You drop them into a tray. Each little piece of metal has a different character stamped on it. So a different letter of the alphabet. You then ink up these letters. You place the papers. You ink up the letters. You put the place the letters in a tray. Ink up the letters. You place paper on the letters. You press down. This is a printing press, and then you have your page. The advantage that movable type had over woodblock printing is once you're done printing your page, you pop the letters out of the tray, and you can rearrange them for the next page. So Gutenberg's invention of the movable type printing press was huge for Renaissance Europe. It made printing books much faster and thus far less expensive. In addition to books, you can now have newspapers. You can now have pamphlets and flyers and ways to very quickly spread information. No longer were books a luxury for the wealthy, so regular people could now afford them. Regular people had access to reading material. When information is less expensive, more people have access to it. When more people have access to information, their ability to read and write, or the literacy, goes up. Today, if you go online, you can find an enormous database of free electronic or e-books that you can download to a Kindle or a Nook or your iPad or your iPhone or iPod Touch, whatever, any other type of e-reader system. The website that you can go to access all these centuries of the world knowledge, here's the website, Gutenberg.org, as a tribute to the man who made possible this greater access to information, Johannes Gutenberg. All right, so this brings us now to our final standard of the quarter, standard 7.8.5, Art, Science, and Literature of the Renaissance. So we just finished learning all about Renaissance art and literature in class. So really the best thing to do is just review all that we've learned in the last 2 weeks. Remember, we focused primarily on three artists, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Brunelleschi. We learned about how Renaissance art was different from medieval art. It was more realistic. It was more three-dimensional. It was more expressive. You saw the expressions on people's faces. Well, it was also more naked, too, I guess. But that's really, it just all goes back to the definition of Renaissance, right? So Renaissance, again, means rebirth, and Renaissance art was supposed to be a rebirth of the classical techniques of ancient Greek and Roman art. The Greeks and the Romans, they celebrated the human body in their paintings and sculptures, and that's exactly what the Renaissance artists were doing. You can see the definition of muscles, even the veins, on the arms of the, Renaissance sculptures. Paintings had depth and seemed to come alive in the Renaissance version of 3D. That was called linear perspective. By establishing a vanishing point on the horizon and having all lines in a painting converge on that vanishing point, artists like Masaccio and Brunelleschi were able to make it appear as though you could actually step into a painting. It gave the illusion of depth. You learned an overview of Renaissance literature when you did level 10 in your levels project. And then back when I was away at that conference, you learned about Renaissance literature from Mr. Jacobs. I think Mr. Jacobs focused specifically on Dante's Inferno, about the different levels of hell that sinners would pass through after they died if they led a wicked life on earth. No, one of the levels was not 24 hours of continuously listening to Justin Bieber music, although some 7th grade boys would argue otherwise. It was actually supposed to teach people a lesson, to scare them into leading a good moral life. Another author who taught good life lessons was William Shakespeare. He wrote some poetry, but is perhaps best known for his plays like Hamlet, Macbeth, Julius Caesar, and perhaps his most famous of all, Romeo and Juliet. Shakespeare's work has lasted for so long because he did such a great job at understanding and interpreting the human condition. He explored universal themes of love, greed, jealousy, power, fear, laughter, joy, marriage, rivalry, revenge. These are themes that you find in all of great literature. But Shakespeare was such a great storyteller that his plays are still performed on stages all over the world still today. His work is still studied by students from middle schools to universities. His characters and stories are featured in movies that today bring in hundreds of millions of dollars in ticket sales. I just went to took my family to go see Romeo and Juliet a couple weeks ago. That's Shakespeare. Some call William Shakespeare the best author ever in the history of the English language, and he died over 400 years ago. So he has had a very lasting impression on English literature and culture up until today. All right, well, that's it for quarter three. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Mr. Ippolito's Benchmark Review Cup podcast, and good luck on your test. Thanks for listening.